Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Satire on TV, political satire, is what we talk about this hour of the program. Our guest writes that it may not sway votes, but that's not the point. Special emphasis on John Oliver's new program Last Week Tonight. We, of course, will talk about Jon Stewart's program and Stephen Colbert's. Amber Day has studied these shows. Amber is Assistant Professor of Literary and Cultural Studies at Bryant University and author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate. And her piece that we mentioned just now appeared on Election Day. So let's look at all of these programs. Are they getting people more engaged in the political process, or do they just attract people who are already pretty engaged in the political process? If you watch these shows regularly, you certainly know what the issues are. Do they prompt people to take political action? And we're going to hear pieces from all of the shows, too, so we'll have a little bit of laughter during the course of this hour, which is always a wonderful thing. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Amber. For those of you who regularly watch any of these programs, what is their place on TV? Do they make you more ready to take action or even to vote, to become involved in the political process? Or is it already just preaching to the choir? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, like us while you are there, and you'll get announcements of upcoming shows, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Amber Day, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you here. So the question you ask, will political satire influence the outcome of an upcoming election? Could a comedian have an impact in the political sphere?
And to be clear, I think that's the question that I most often get asked. And I think I was, in that piece, was reacting a little bit crankily to the question itself, because I wanted to say, well, if you're talking about influencing an election, probably not. But that's not to say that it doesn't have any effect. And in fact, satire, I think, is particularly contemporary satire, is quite important. And it is having an impact in the political sphere. But we tend to think about effect very, very narrowly.
Mm-hmm. So what is the impact in the political sphere?
Well, I mean, I think people like Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and now John Oliver have done a very good job of shifting the conversation, you know, in small ways around particular topics. So they, you know, provide different frameworks for looking at particular subjects that we may be talking about in other venues, or they pull back the curtain and give us a look at how it is being discussed in media circles that perhaps is not the most productive way to be discussed, mm-hmm. you know, and sort of pointing to the way in which talking points are being repeated over and over and over again, which don't actually mean anything. And that's a really helpful service, right? And it's something that there's a real lack of. I mean, they're sort of filling a void because there's a hunger to sort of hear that critique being made, and it's not really being made in a lot of other venues.
Isn't that true about those talking points? If you follow politics at all, you realize that politicians have this down to an art, and if you listen enough, it drives you nuts.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that is very much the appeal for fans of these programs, is just that feeling of being driven nuts and really wanting to have somebody else see what you see, right, and hear what you hear, and actually maybe push beyond and try to interrogate some of those talking points. So there's a real sort of satisfaction that one gets as an audience member if that's your feeling already going in, that, like, there's something wrong with this conversation. There's something wrong with just hearing talking points over and over again. And when I turn on the news shows that are supposed to be, you know, investigative journalism, I'm just hearing people repeating those points over and over again.
Right. So let's talk about the audience for a moment. I'm wondering about the demographic makeup of the audience and whether or not it is true, and you mentioned this in your piece. Do you become well-informed from watching these shows, or are you already well-informed and so you are attracted to the show?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. And I mean, honestly, it's very difficult to tease out, and I don't think anyone can completely kind of, it's so hard to separate one aspect of your life from others and say, you know, this aspect of your knowledge is from this program. And I think it is both. And I think it's sort of, you know, self-perpetuating that you have to have some interest in politics and some attention to what's going on to actually get the jokes on the program. You're engaged at some level, right? But I think, you know, the program also, you can certainly learn plenty from it, depending on the night, but any of these programs, right? Because they spend a long time on one particular story, and although there'll be lots of silly fart jokes and things thrown in as well, you may actually also get a great deal of background knowledge. So, for instance, during the Iraq War, there were segments that I looked at in which they, you know, the Daily Show was giving a lot more detail on the sort of sectarian nature of the conflict and some of the background than the straight news was.
Mm-hmm. Do any of the shows inspire people, or is it an express purpose to take action, to go sign a petition, to go and vote, to work on a certain issue?
Yes, I believe so. I mean, there's anecdotal evidence, but that for instance, you know, some of the earlier programs, they're at least being, the segments are there being used to, are being forwarded by folks for political means, you know, so advocacy organizations are grabbing the clips and then using them to help continue amplify that critique that's being made. But, you know, Jon Stewart's show and Stephen Colbert's show are not attempting to be activists, the performers are not attempting to be activists. They are satirists. John Oliver is kind of an interesting figure because he's sort of verging a little bit closer to that activism territory. And he is offering, more often, he is offering actual instructions about what one can do if you are upset about a particular issue. He's not offering instructions about partisan politics, precisely, but more sort of pressing social issues for instance, one that I mentioned in that article is the net neutrality debates,
yes,
which, you know, are still playing out. And he, you know, famously kind of told his audience, look, if this gets you upset after ranting about it for 13 minutes, you know, he said, if this gets you upset, they are requesting comments at the FCC, you know, and in fact, he gave a much more impassioned speech than that. And, you know, and said, this is your opportunity. All of you people who spend your time online commenting about things and getting very upset about irrelevant details, you know, this is your moment. This is what you've been training for. Turn on your caps locks and go.
And is it true that he flooded the phone lines at the FCC?
I believe so. I mean, that's the story.
Yeah. Let's listen to him. Here's Oliver, John Oliver, his comments on net neutrality.
I could show you the troublingly cozy relationship between cable companies and Washington in any number of ways. I could show you the president golfing with the CEO of Comcast, or saying at a fundraiser at a cable executive's house that he'd been there so many times, the only thing I haven't done in this house is have Seder dinner. But perhaps the most succinct way is this.
The president has picked Tom Wheeler, a former top lobbyist for cable and wireless companies, to be the next chair of the Federal Communications Commission.
Yes. The guy who used to run the cable industry's lobbying arm is now running the agency tasked with regulating it. That is the equivalent of needing a babysitter and hiring a dingo. Here, thanks for stopping over. Just make sure they're in bed by 8. There's $20 on the table for kibble. So, please don't eat my baby. With the fact that they are practically overseeing their own oversight, it is hardly surprising that cable companies are basically monopolies now. A federal study found that 96% of the population had access to two or fewer cable broadband providers. It's almost as if they've agreed to stay out of each other's way like drug cartels. But hold on, no, that's not fair. I mean, if hypothetically a cable company like Comcast were planning to merge with a company like, let's say, Time Warner. It's not like their CEO would sit down and mark out who had which turf, right?
Both in video and in broadband, we don't compete with Time Warner. You have to start with that very fundamental point. They're in New York, we're in Philadelphia, they're in L.A., we're in San Francisco. You can't buy a Comcast in New York, you can't buy a Time Warner in Philadelphia. So there's no reduction in competition.
Exactly. You can't reduce competition when nobody is competing. You could not be describing a monopoly more clearly if you were wearing a metal top hat while driving a metal car after winning second prize in a beauty contest.
John Oliver on net neutrality, and there it is in 2 minutes and 13 seconds. There's the essence of net neutrality, right, Amber?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he does a very good job of distilling down what the issues are, right? What the conflict of interest is, and what people who are concerned about this are concerned about.
One of my favorite Oliver shows was when he was talking about global warming and had 99% of the scientists and 1% who disagrees, and he had 99 scientists come on stage and then had one. It was just it was dramatic, and it was quite funny and very pointed.
Yes, and I think, and so that's the sort of media criticism piece that I think that these shows do so well, in that, you know, they... We think about the tenet of being objective for the press as a good thing, but there are a lot of people who work on this who have pointed out that the way in which that's interpreted is actually often harmful, right? So this tenet of objectivity means that, okay, if we're talking about global warming, then we have to present it as a debate, right? Because there are people who disagree, and so you set it up as here's somebody who agrees and here's somebody who disagrees. But of course, that's not actually representative at all, right? If 98 or 99, whatever the statistic is, scientists believe, right, that in global warming, and two or three do not, right? And I think he just does a very good job of kind of illustrating that in a really obvious way.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. You can leave messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at @KDunnShow. We're talking about what it is that Parity News is accomplishing, and looking specifically at The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert's Colbert Report, and John Oliver's new program as well, and playing a few clips from them too. What do you think the role is? What impact does it have on our political discussion? We welcome your phone calls. And let's start with an email message. I try to watch Jon Stewart every night. He makes me laugh and really puts me in a good mood before I go to bed. Also, he has some great guests who contribute so much to the program. I think this thing about making people laugh, because things can get so darn dismal politically and there's so much dysfunction, even to have it pointed out in a humorous way can give us really needed release in terms of laughing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think, I mean, there's a sort of, obviously, that's pleasurable. And it also, I think, provides some cover, too, in that we are more open to sort of hearing critique made if it's made with behind a screen of laughter, right, or made within humor.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Linnea in Washburn. Hi. Linnea, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go right ahead.
Hi. I wanted to call in because I appreciate your guests' view of satire as a means of pointing out the hypocrisy that we have in society and its long and important role. But I also wanted to point out that I'm a big fan of Stephen Colbert and the 2006 White House Correspondents' Dinner. If you haven't seen it, you should see it on YouTube. Was probably the hardest-hitting critique of a Bush that of a president that took us to war, and I applaud him for that, and I applaud him for his courage.
You bring up an interesting phrase, because it does take a certain amount of courage for these comedians to say what they say, don't you think, Amber?
Absolutely. And obviously, I think that's a really great example. And for anyone who hasn't seen it, this was Stephen Colbert was invited to this dinner and was sitting, you know, several feet away from the president of the time, George W. Bush, and issued a very scathing critique, not just of him, but also of the press and their press's relationship to him as the press sat in front of him, right? Because that's who the dinner was for.
Right.
And it really, I mean, it was biting. And it's interesting because there was a sort of flap afterwards, because at first it wasn't reported on very much, and then there were a number of people who had seen it who said, why hasn't there been more said about this? You know, we've been waiting for somebody to make this critique. And then there was this whole controversy about, you know, is somebody hiding this and what's going on? But I think, you know, for those who were still supporting George Bush, they didn't find it all that funny. But for those on the left who were wanting to hear that critique made and were just hungering for it, it almost didn't matter how funny it was. I mean, I think it was funny, but that was almost beside the point, right? It was his courage, and it was just the relief of having somebody actually say that out loud and say it so sort of cogently and you know, with the president right there, that it was just – that's why it became such a sensation.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing you can say, particularly I think for Jon Stewart's program, it probably more often than not has more of a progressive bent to it. But he's an equal opportunity criticizer too. He really points to power, and when power is not used correctly, or when the truth is not being told, be you a Democrat or a Republican or a police officer or whatever.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, all three of these programs, the performers do lean liberal, and they don't try to hide that. I mean, I think that's part of the appeal, is they're very sort of honest and open about their own opinions. But I would argue, and I know some people disagree with me, but I would argue that the shows are not partisan, in that they're really not doing anyone's bidding, right? They're certainly not repeating the talking points of the Democratic Party. And there are many times in which they will go after, you know, President Obama in particular right now for things that they find disappointing that he's doing. So it's really not about, you know, cheerleading for any one side, but is mainly about these larger issues like hypocrisy and you know, openness and transparency, getting actually to the issues, right? Mm-hmm. So getting us beyond just the sort of political horse race and actually trying to talk through some of the issues.
Brody is next in Pewaukee. Hi.
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 Just like to reiterate the point about, you know, John Oliver being like actual news disguised as satirical comedy. I mean, he's doing a great job on things like payday loan vendors and for-profit colleges, and like specifically the story he just did, I think, like a week ago about ALEC and the state legislators across the country and how they're just pumping out legislation that still has the ALEC symbol on it. And just, I thought that was an amazing story.
Right. And I think John Oliver obviously has a huge staff behind him, but he's using that staff for good. And he's, you know, they're doing quite a lot of investigative work. I mean, they're doing journalism.
Mm-hmm.
So they're certainly creating comedy out of it, but the research, everything that goes into it is real journalism. There's no doubt about it.
Amber Day is our guest, assistant professor of literary and cultural studies at Bryant University, author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate. And we're talking about the political programs on cable television, the ones that are most popular, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert's Colbert Report, and John Oliver's new program Last Week Tonight, and welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. What is their role in the body politic in this country? What is their role in your lives if you watch any of these? Why? 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What we'll be doing tomorrow is, hold on, I got to find out. Here we go. We're going to repeat a show with Elizabeth Rosenthal, important one. They all are on the skyrocketing cost of vaccinations. She's been doing a series for the New York Times on healthcare costs. So that's what will happen tomorrow during this hour. And you are invited. It's a ticketed event. Call Boswell Books for more information tomorrow night at 7 with Colonel Chris Hadfield. Canadian astronaut. So let's play something else. We haven't looked at John Stewart yet. I think he's really a master. He's such a talented man. And we're playing a few clips. We'll ask our guest, Professor Amber Day, to analyze this. But to set it up, this is John Stewart on The Daily Show talking about the Ferguson police crackdown in the wake of protests over the Michael Brown shooting. It starts, as he does frequently, with news reports from Fox News and from other sources. This is from The Daily Show.
Is he going to get a fair shake, this officer?
There has been a rush to judgment.
Eric Holder flies into Ferguson, with his superhero cape.
This mantra of the unarmed black teenager shot by a white cop, you know, that description in and of itself actually colors the way in which we look at this story.
Yes. Describing the actual facts of the case. Really does color the way we look at it. White cop shoots unarmed black teen does sound terrible. Whereas, say, hero cop kills alien hunting humans for sport would put a completely different spin on things. Which, though a very accurate description of the plot of Predator 2, is in this case not what happened. And you know what? There's so many other stories out there.
Why aren't we covering New York?
Why aren't we covering black-on-black crime?
Yes! Why all the interest in holding police officers to a higher standard than gangs? They both flash colors, and yes, one of them has been sworn to protect and defend, but still...
Well, this weekend, 42 people shot in Chicago. You know, I don't see the protests. I don't see the anger.
If I were African-American, I would be outraged that more journalists aren't covering what's happening in Chicago, and more outraged that people like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson don't head to those areas.
Yes. What could explain the lack of outrage about Al Sharpton and his ilk not doing anything about black-on-black violence in Chicago?
With Chicago's violence making national headlines, a group led by the Reverend Al Sharpton plans to convene an anti-violence summit of national civil rights leaders here.
Oh, that's right, because African-American leaders did hold a summit about that in November and have met at least three times in the city just in the last 13 months, which is not to say it's been effective, but taken along with the president's My Brother's Keeper initiative, which attempts to address this violence and the countless vigils and marches within these violence-torn communities, means they are trying, actually, to do something. You see, you being ignorant of those attempts doesn't mean the issue itself is being ignored, in the same way that when it snows where you live doesn't mean the world isn't getting hotter.
There's so much in that piece, isn't there? And again, you hear from Fox News the theme of why aren't you covering black-on-black crime? You wonder how certain themes develop. If you sit down at a table and you decide this is what angle you're going to take on a story, and you do the same angle over and over and over again instead of looking what facts are in a case, right?
Right, right. Well, and I mean there is some of the reporting on Roger Ailes. has indicated that in fact they at Fox in particular there tends to be a sort of, you know, these are the stories and these are the talking points of the day, but John Stewart does a great job. I think there's a lot of critique in there, and he's not afraid to point to the hypocrisy and point to the assumptions that are being made and the framing of the piece, and I think all of it. It's really smart.
John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. I think sometimes in Congress they have things happen that are pretty, topical and also funny. Alan Grayson, especially, very funny as congressman from Florida, and when he's questioning these people from the Federal Reserve Bank. But you can't get that on television. Although he was on Bill Maher's show, and he did even refer to Huey Long, you know, the share of the wealth congressman. But in Europe, they have plenty of rebellion in the parliament because you got many political parties in Germany. They've got the Linke Party, which is like the old Communist Party, and then you got the National Democrats, and then you got all the parties in between. And they really attack intelligently and with humor Merkel. They make Merkel squirm in her seat and leave the parliament because she is being exposed, you know, for the banker tout and warmongering woman that she is, like our Hillary Clinton.
Do you see a lot of humor in Congress? Do you watch C-SPAN at all, Amber, and notice a similar thread here or not?
I don't know that there's that the humor is just that we would be watching C-SPAN and laughing. I think there is a lot of humor there when it's unpacked, right? And that's what somebody like Stewart or Colbert or John Oliver does well, in that when you take a segment from C-SPAN and you, recontextualize it within the frame of satire, and we've already been set up to look for particular things, then we absolutely see them, and they are funny. It's not like they're coming with talent and with writers and with all sorts of things to provide that infrastructure. So no, C-SPAN itself, I don't find all that funny.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Jerry in Chilton. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm listening to the discourse, and I think why certainly our new comic political satirists have their place. The way I view it, I think that they have, for the most part, taken over or morphed into the replacement for the political satiristic cartoonists that everybody used to look for in the papers and see was part of their daily lives. And they certainly had an impact. They had an influence. And I think the newer, later, greater versions that we have now, like Colbert and Oliver and that, beyond a doubt, can influence and get people thinking and talking.
Mm. Oh, I think absolutely. And of course, there's a reason why they're popular right now, and in terms of what there is to actually poke fun of, and a lot of their targets are cable news, that is easier to satirize within television. So, it makes sense that this form are great satirists in news are on television right now. Not to say that there aren't good cartoonists as well, but I think that's why the popularity here.
And Eric, along similar lines from Madison, was wondering if we can compare these comedy shows to other earlier forms of satire. Can we make any comparison to Mark Twain, for example?
Well, sure. I think satire in general has been around probably as long as there has been politics. it definitely fulfills a role of trying to to keep us honest, right? And to not let the pomp and circumstance and the high-flown rhetoric and all of that sort of carry the day without being tweaked, right, and without being called out when it is wrong. Certainly there's a direct line between earlier forms of satire and contemporary forms of satire. I think there are different moments in history in which we have satire has become more prominent, and I think that speaks more to the moment than it does even to the particular satirists involved. It speaks to the audience looking for that sort of critique, or the fact that that sort of critique isn't being made in other venues.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Stephen Colbert's transition to television, which he'll be taking over the David Letterman show pretty soon now, his show ending in December. Do you imagine that's going – how much of the political satire, if anything, can he carry from his fictional character, who's very pointed, to mainstream night after night interview program on NBC? Can he carry any of that? Will we expect him to carry some of that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he's certainly not bringing his character with him. He said as much, and it wouldn't work. But he, you know, he is bringing what's underneath it, which is he's very smart, he's sharp, he has a background in improv comedy, and all of that will be brought with him. I mean, I think there will be some aspects of it that he will likely have to tone down for network television. Certainly the language that can be used and all of
right.
that. But I'm hoping that, you know, the core of his critique will remain, though I think, you know, we have to sort of wait and see.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jerry, for your call. Marty in Appleton. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Marty.
Actually, a couple points that I'd like to just quickly discuss. One, if your guest could comment on the relationship between a disillusioned public and the rise in satirists. And two, why does she feel that maybe right-wing satire just simply hasn't worked?
Okay. So I'll answer the first question first, which is that I do think, you know, we've touched on this a little bit, but basically, you know, public relations, the sort of PR language of politicians and corporations and public speakers of all sorts has gotten really polished and good. to a large degree, journalism hasn't quite kept up. And I think NPR is a notable exception there. But a lot of the reportage that is being done isn't, as we said, going beyond the sort of PR language, the talking points, all of that. And so there is this desire to poke holes in the spectacle, right, to see the curtain being drawn back and to have somebody point out, look, this folksy town hall meeting is entirely staged, right? And these people aren't being asked difficult questions. Here are the more difficult questions we wish we could ask them.
Right.
So I think that, you know, that there's definitely a need for that sort of critique and a hunger for it. In terms of the right-wing satire, I mean, I think there's a few different reasons. You know, partially these shows developed, Jon Stewart in particular, developed, really became popular and found his voice during George Bush's administration. So he very much was venting anger, feeling that particular points of view and ways of thinking were not being represented in the mainstream discourse or in, you know, in politics itself. And it was, you know, after September 11th when there was what many have seen as a sort of soft peddling on behalf of journalists around George W. Bush, and a sort of fear of critiquing and being seen as unpatriotic. And so Jon Stewart kind of rose up to fill that void. So it was very tied to that experience of being somebody on the left and feeling frustrated. But you know, and so he became the sort of standard bearer. And there have been a couple of attempts to develop, quote, you know, right-wing satire. But as I'd mentioned earlier, I don't think of what Jon Stewart does as partisan, in that he's not, you know, shilling for the Democratic Party or for anyone else. And I think you know, what he does well is that media criticism. And when folks have tried to set out to do, quote, right-wing satire, they have tended to hew too closely to the party line. Right. And that it has read as just sort of cheerleading for one side. And that's not all that funny. And it's not all that smart or incisive. So although he's liberal, he's not, you know, I would say he's not really doing partisan work. He's doing good satire.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very, very much, Marty. Insightful call. Linda from Townsend sent this email. We record the Jon Stewart Show and watch it each day. His honesty regarding what's happening is so refreshing and puts things in perspective, other than the doom and gloom that regular news programs have the country in. Doom and gloom.
Doom and gloom.
Yeah. There is a lot of doom and gloom, isn't there? You watch the news and you're, oh my gosh, I feel great after this.
Yes, yes. No, absolutely. And I think, you know, some of what these programs do is sort of show the way in which some of that is manufactured, right? The sort of Ebola crisis and the fear around Ebola in the United States and that sort of thing. But that's not to say, you know, that there are world events that are quite depressing. And I think, you know, we certainly want to continue to get reportage on such things. I think, and I don't think Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert or John Oliver wants to minimize the importance of any of that, but it does help to, I think, cut it with some humor.
Tim in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I think what the Daily Show and John Oliver and all of them are doing is really using George Carlin's template for a joke. Basically, he said that all you really need for a joke is one thing to be drastically out of proportion. So if you think about a very small man wearing a very large hat, it's funny. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have to make up the very large hat, and you can just find somebody wearing a very large hat, it's very funny, and the other networks are doing it for him. They're doing the writer's jobs. All they have to do is find something that is funny and point it out to us.
Yeah, good point.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, and Stewart has said as much himself, right? He said, I think when he was on Bill Moyer's show, he says, you know, all we do is distill things down to its most humorous nugget. We take the news of the day and we just sort of distill it down. So, right, they're not, and that's how, you know, these shows are different than much of what came before on television in that they're not making up news stories or doing caricatures or funny voices. For the most part, they're reporting the news, but they are zeroing in on the small man in the large hat.
More phone calls in a moment. Our phone number for Amber Day, and she is Associate Professor of English and Cultural Studies at Bryant University, author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. We're talking about the programs, particularly The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, The Colbert Report, and John Oliver's relatively new program, all on Comedy Central, and the role that they have in taking on people who are not being honest, taking on how the news takes on certain issues of the day, and asking whether or not there is a political impact. Do people who watch the show regularly, do they become more involved politically? Or is it just a way to escape the doom and gloom of the daily news? More phone calls momentarily. Tim, thanks very much for your call. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We've been playing some clips from these various programs just because it's adds to the show, and quite frankly, it's a bit of fun. And this one, again, this is John Oliver, and his take on the issue of campaign finance rules on the amount we spend in elections, and it focuses on one race in the South. Here's John Oliver.
Are there any limits left on campaign finance anymore? Corporations are people. People can give pretty much whatever they like, all of which has led us to the point where one state in the midterm elections is set to have the most expensive Senate race ever. And I'll give you a clue. It is the 50th state that you are thinking of.
Well, it could end up being a $100 million race, the battle for the United States Senate seat in Kentucky.
Kentucky? $100 million for Kentucky? Look, no offense, Kentucky. I'm a big fan of your fried chicken. And I proudly watch your derby each year, mostly to find names for my thrash metal ska fusion band. We are Dance with Fate, and we are extremely loud. Now, you might well ask, why are Kentuckians giving so much money to their candidates? Well, funny story, they're not. The two likely candidates are Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and his Democratic opponent, Alison Lundigan Grimes. And the vast majority of their big donor money comes from out of state. So let's not pretend that Kentucky's election has anything to do with Kentucky anymore. Each candidate has been using some of their money to scorch the earth with negative ads.
Professor Amber Day. He has a kind of passion about him that's different than the other two shows, doesn't he? I mean, he's really into the issue. He's really engaged in the issue, and he makes you think, how could they be spending this kind of money? You sort of get enraged yourself when you listen to it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other two are passionate as well. They have a slightly different demeanor in terms of their delivery. But you can feel, there are times when you feel that they feel very strongly about the issue being presented. But Oliver, that is part of the sort of, not character, but the persona that he delivers, which is just an earnestness. There's an earnestness about him.
Absolutely. Chris in Gurnee, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, I love your show, by the way, Kathleen.
Thanks, Chris.
I wanted to just make the comment. It's not so much a question, although if your guest has any opinion on it, I'd love to hear it. My comment is that these shows really help me talk about the issues with my teenager.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's not going to watch Meet the Press or, you know.
I know. Or the Nightly News. Yeah, I'm with you. I know what you're saying exactly. I think it's true. It brings in a whole younger crowd. And if you're trying to get your young people interested in politics, this may be the way to do it, Amber.
Sure. I think absolutely. And I think there's, you know, not just for young people, but for there are a lot of people who feel like the language that's used in other venues just doesn't speak to them, or it doesn't address them, or they feel excluded from it. And I think, you know, there is this, in the sort of entertainment politics world, it is more accessible, right? And these shows, there are some forms of entertainment politics that are accessible but are a little bit vapid, but these are accessible and also substantive, right? So there's, which is a win-win. And I think, you know, we have a tendency to think of it as either or, right? Either we are talking about something serious or we're laughing. But we absolutely can be doing both. And I think certainly we laugh in these programs, but we're absolutely thinking. And that's, you know, that's sort of the kind of magic sweet spot that they get.
Right. Do you watch every night with your teenager, Chris?
No, we don't. Actually, it's kind of late, you know, and with school. And we usually watch it on YouTube, actually.
Uh-huh.
She's the one that actually pointed it out to me that it's on YouTube.
Oh, I didn't even know that either. That's good to know. It's on YouTube. Yeah, I'm just sort of getting into YouTube. I'm a little late to the story.
Full episodes, but we've, you know, looked at it and picked out various topics that we find interesting and looked at it that way.
Right.
But I just worry a little bit about cynicism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they are cynical, obviously. That's what kind of makes them funny. And I just worry, you know, that I don't want my 14-year-old to be too terribly jaded, but I don't know. I guess she's going to get that from me anyway, so I'm going to try to balance it.
That's actually, you've hit on an issue that is debated all over the place in the academic literature on this stuff, about whether or not these programs are cynical or whether they cause audience members to be cynical. I've argued pretty forcefully that they do not. And I think, you know, there have been a couple studies that have tried to show that they do increase cynicism in young people. But in general, what they found is that they increase sort of dissatisfaction with news coverage.
Oh.
And I don't think that's the same as cynicism. Oh. I mean, I think when we talk about cynicism, a destructive form of cynicism, we're talking about a feeling like, well, what's the point? They're all a bunch of, you know, it's just the whole system is awful, you know. And that's not the message that is regularly sent on these programs. In fact, you know, the message tends to be we deserve better, right? That there is an alternative. There could be an alternative. We wish there were an alternative, right? Which I think is different than cynicism. It implies that we should engage with, right? That you can, and we've already remarked on, say, John Oliver and his sort of passion and earnestness. Clearly, this is something he feels very strongly about. He's not just sort of tossing off one-liners from the corner of the room in a sort of snarky way about people walking by, right? These are issues that he feels very passionately about, and I think, you know, that passion certainly rubs off, right, when we're watching the show, that we sort of feel the urgency, whether we are as urgent about every single issue he talks about, maybe not, but we feel that it's not simply a game, right? It is something that he's asking us to care about.
Thank you, Chris, so much for your call. Margie in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I love all of those shows, John Oliver and Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. And what it's taught me is when I was confused and upset about something, it gave me a focus. Well, that's why I was confused. Yeah, it wasn't just me. And the satire has made me think about things. And I think, as Stephen Colbert once said, you're not going to find my show humorous unless you understand what I'm joking about. Mm-hmm. And so there's been a number of times on any one of those shows I've had to look something up because I didn't get the joke. And I didn't get the joke because I didn't understand the details.
Oh, that's interesting.
And one thing that I thought was interesting in a recent article that someone wrote on John Oliver, I think it was Rolling Stones, he said he is very concerned and a little pessimistic. John Stewart, on the other hand, is totally optimistic. So when I'm really discouraged about something, I watch John Stewart because he thinks things are going to get better. He really does. And I think that comes through from the type of guests that he talks to. He's not afraid to talk to anybody on any side of the party. And I think that's so healthy.
Amber.
I think in terms of, we haven't talked yet about the interviews, but,
right.
You know, Daily Show and the Colbert Report are one of the only places actually you can go to on television to hear interviews about on you know academics and thinkers who are writing about interest you know I guess how to put this you know serious subjects right and have a serious discussion about those things and have a discussion across party lines much of the time that isn't a shouting match necessarily right. I think there was a really interesting interview that Jon Stewart just did with Bill O'Reilly recently, and he's done a lot of interviews with Bill O'Reilly. They tend to have this relationship. They keep coming back for it. But they had one after all of the Michael Brown coverage and where Jon Stewart was pressing him on to admit that there was such a thing as white privilege, and there was this back and forth. But they're really interesting exchanges because they clearly disagree with each other to a huge degree, but there also is an attempt to sort of come to a place, something that they agree about, right, and trying to find that.
Mm. See, I think that's where both of those shows kind of fall down because it's nice that they are giving some attention to books, but the segments are so incredibly short that it always leaves me wanting, and they tend to be not as deep, not as comprehensive as the other parts of their show.
No, I think you're right. I mean, they do only have a half-hour format, right? And it's a sort of one portion of the show. So I think there's only so much they can do. But in a way, they sort of extended what is otherwise the sort of celebrity chat, right? So it's usually an actor, an actress there to promote a movie. And so they've brought in this other material. And so, yeah, I think the talks sort of scratch the surface, but you at least are getting advertisement for books that you can speak
Absolutely.
Out on your own or issues you can
yeah.
look at. It.
Okay. And giving public radio stations like ours ideas for shows sometimes,
yeah.
too. I think,
yeah.
oh, there's a good topic. We need to do this for an hour at some point.
Right.
Well,
right.
Thank you very much, Amber Day, for being with us. It was a great way for us to have some fun this hour as well and to look at something that's a pretty big thing in American society. And I think on the whole, it's a good thing.
Great. Well, thanks for having me. This
yeah,
was fun.
Our pleasure. Amber Day, our guest this hour, Associate Professor of English and Cultural Studies at Bryant University. Her book is Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate. And we were looking at the shows on TV, the political satire programs, Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, John Oliver's new program, and Stephen Colbert's program. It will be interesting to see what Stephen Colbert does when he becomes this, you know, more mainstream, although he's going to bring his own sense of whatever it's going to be. There'll be something very different about that show as a result of his being the host, I would imagine. Thanks very much to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for doing on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Tomorrow during this time period, Elizabeth Rosenthal, we're going to repeat a program because I'm preparing for a public interview tomorrow night with former astronaut Colonel Chris Hadfield, who was with us on the air about a year ago, actually. And he is talking about the pictures, this event tomorrow night, the pictures that he took. It's a beautiful book from space. He's an artist, he's a musician, and he is in terrific shape because you have to be in perfect shape to be one of these space station people who go there for months at a time. So Elizabeth Rosenthal on the skyrocketing cost of vaccinations tomorrow during this time period. Thanks for listening.